work it out. Okay, so the flux coming from the sun is whatever sigma for A to the fourth. And so then the question is, like, as I was vaguely remembering here, so you don't want the angle, you need the solid angle. This is where I screwed up. So the solid angle of the lens, and this is backwards. So from the perspective of the sun, the solid angle of the lens is the area of the lens, like the divided by the area, the A of the lens divided by the area to the Earth, of the Earth's orbit. So this will be pi, the diameter of the lens over 2 squared divided by 4 pi r squared, which is just b squared over 16 r squared. So that's the solid angle filled up by the lens, fraction of the total, the fraction of the total flux that will enter the lens will be given by this. So then the next thing you need to know is that what the size of the image on the log will be. So if we have our lens here, and then the sun is this big, and it gets converged to have an image of the sun here. And it's large here, and small here. The diameter of the image will be given by the actual diameter of the sun divided by the distance times the focal length, and then this is in fact theta, where theta is the angular size of the sun. Okay, happy with that? Does that make sense? And so we need to use this fact. So the energy leaving the sun is going to be the flux times the area of the sun, of the sun's surface. This is going to cancel out, though, so don't worry. Don't get too attached to it. And so the area entering energy entering the lens will be given by the total energy of the sun divided by the area of the sphere at the location of the Earth times the area of the lens. Okay, this is, or in other words, E theta times the solid angle of the lens. And that works out to be A pi sine of the fourth, R sine squared, E lens squared over 4R Earth's orbit squared. Okay, and then so then the flux at the log, or the wood, or whatever, is going to be the energy entering the lens divided by the area of the image. And so this is where things cancel out. And so the area of the image is, as we just calculated here, this could be coming from this. So this will be E lens divided by pi times d of the image over 2 squared And this will be 4 over pi diameter of the sun divided by r times f, the focal length, times a pi p, temperature of the sun to the fourth, r sun squared, diameter of the lens squared, or radius of the Earth's orbit squared. So lots of things cancel, and this is equal to a e fourth over f squared, where now we've defined f is equal to the focal length by the temperature. And so you see all the radii have dropped out because we're taking the ratio of the area of the size of the total energy divided by the size of the image. Now this image is going to get, this is where your intuition breaks a little bit. The image is, so the point is that this flux is going to be constant no matter how far you are away. So the size of the image is going to get smaller because the size of this image is related to the solid angle of the sun that the sun takes up. So if you go an infinite, you know, if you go a million light years away, then the sun will take up make a very small image indeed. The flux that you get will be the same at that image as it was anywhere, but total power will be very, very tiny. Though it doesn't, of course, it doesn't stay that. That's actually also not true, as we were talking about before everyone got back, which is Olber's paradox is basically this: if you preserve flux like this completely, then the entire night sky would be full because there's always enough, would always seem to be enough stars to fill up every point in space. So the universe is expanding, so it doesn't hold. So finally, now what you do is you just say you equate this impingent flux to a black body temperature, which again is an approximation. And then you say that the black body temperature there is going to be this albedo times that number. And so the temperature of the wood due to this will be basically the sun, the temperature of the sun, and then the fourth root of 1 over 2f squared. And so then you can plug in the numbers and get the, if we, again, if you, so the, if the temperature of the sun is like 6,000 and the temperature of the wood is like 1,000, what? Let's just make it 600 for ease of calculation. So 600 divided by 6,000, the fourth root 2f squared is just 1/10. 1/10 to the 4 is 1 over 10 to the 4, equals 1 over 2 squared. F will be equal to 1 over square root of 2, 10. Is that right? Yeah. So that's like 100 over square root of 2. For the focal. What? Yeah, so it's like a focal ratio of what?
You can have a small, 70. You know, a pretty small diameter.
The focal length has to be considerably longer. I mean, the focal length could be pretty long. Compared to, it doesn't have to be a strongly converging lens to get to the minimum. If I did that right, I think I did right. I mean, obviously you can play with the numbers a little bit. But. Which one? This one?
In principle, we have to have a point like of in focus.
Right.
I suppose this problem is
That's only approximately true. Good enough. The point is just you just need a scaling between the size of the image and the size of and the focal.
Yeah, but like in ideal case, your image is the rank is zero. If you put something.
No, right? I mean, this is just geometric optics. So. Right, it's going to be whatever the this will be the focal length, right? And that'll tell you how big the image is.
Yeah, but if you take the signs really far away, so.
Yeah, so that's why. I mean, by taking the sun far away, that's why I could suppress the sign here, and it's just theta. So it's just. So this right here, right? This will be the same here, right? And so I think you just work this out.
Okay.
So this is the distance. So this is R, this is D. And so we know so that we now we know what theta is. Let me just redraw this. I've done this in a while. This distance is f, so this is, I guess it's 2f. Not 2f. It's f to here. Is it 2f? I can't remember. Anyway, but so the distance here is going to be related to this distance by theta equals b.
Yeah, that's right. For objects which are not at the focus point,
but
for
people, that's
at
true.
At the focus point, you can calculate the.
No, but so you're not. But they're not at the focus point. I mean, the point is that if it's in focus, then the object still has a finite size. This is a focused object of a finite size. As is the size is related to the size of the other thing by the with the relation that depends on the focus. I'm sure of that. There's
I
not.
Mean, we can erase the image of this object.
No. That's wrong. That the image appears back here. The point is, it's in focus whenever the converged light from here, and the light that goes through the middle undisturbed, it converge on the same point. That's what it means to be in focus. It doesn't. All the light does not end up at the focal point. That's the focal point is the image is the line through whenever you know it's in focus. If this light, the maximally dense light, goes through the focal point, and then the light that goes through the middle is undeflected, match up. It will be close to it, but not necessarily at the focus. Depends.
The focal point is when parallel lines constant.
Right. Exactly. That's right. So the parallel lines go through the focal point. So yeah. It'll be I mean, it's going to be really close to the focal point for this, but not necessarily. It's not going to be exactly at the focal point because there's an angle here, right? Off the theta. It's not. They're not parallel. They're a little bit off of parallel. Because the point is this: if you had a spotlight and you were holding your magnifying glass up against the spotlight, then you would worry about. Then you could think about the focal point, but that's not. That's not what we're calculating. We're calculating a finite size source at a distance that has a finite size. And so these lines, so there is a small angle here. It makes the size of the image finite. I think that's right. It certainly is not everything at the point. All right. Okay, so for the homework, who didn't get the homework assignment? It's email. Okay, so did you go out? You got one? Not you. Okay, so the homework this week is going to be shorter in that it's only two problems, But and so therefore it will be very easy for those of you who already know how to do numerical stuff. But anyway, but this is going to be basically an exercise in doing numerics, because in 2.10 you're going to have to solve some basic inner, both in 2.10 and 2.11, because I'm extending the requirement in 2.11. You're going to have to solve some some basic differential equations numerically, and you can use anything you want. You want to do it in mathematics or MATLAB, C++, whatever, I don't care. This is supposed to be about doing real research, and nobody cares how you get the right answer, so as long as you get to it. And so in problem 2.11, there's two numerical integrations. Do you have the answer to? And so I just want you to verify the answer. And so you'll be turning in your Mathematica script or your code as part of the homework assignment this week. If you need more than, because I know some people are less up on their numerics in this, if you need more than a week to do this one, it's okay. So just let me know if you're having trouble with it, or if you need help, extra help. Because it's fine. Because the numerical part is not like you can just pass it around. Because if anybody ends up with an identical thing, believe me, I'll notice. You should email it to me. The numerical thing, because it's easier than printing it out. It's more readable. Okay, does that make sense? I'm going to give the necessary background for the problem now, the remaining time. Does that make sense, the assignment?
Yeah. Only thing is, I just switched to a new computer. I don't have any math baggage. Anything you would recommend?
Well, I mean, probably you can buy Maple here in Waterloo pretty cheap. Maple is a homegrown product, but most people use Mathematica.
Okay.
So, but you can do it for free with like Fortran or MATLAB.
The computers on campus have both.
Oh, they do? Yeah, the libraries or?
Any computer in your town.
Okay. There you go. You can do it for free.
I'll have to see if my office's computer has it there on campus, but it's Linux preloaded, so you never know.
Right. I mean, I'm not sure what the University of Waterloo has, but I'm glad to hear that they have Mathematica.
Yeah, if you go to an actual computer lab, it's different.
Okay.
Yeah. If it's Linux, then.
Yeah.
So, but but you can, these things can be solved using standard.
Yeah, all else fails, I can always write it in C.
So. That's a little bit more painful.
Yeah.
Okay, so the necessary background. I'm going to start with problem 2 because that's the one that I need to get through, and then we'll take a little bit of time for problem 1. For problem 1, you just for the isothermal sphere. The isothermal sphere is a very important phenomenon, or not phenomenon, it's a useful computational thing that people use all the time in doing research, because you can actually do stuff with it. And so you get the isothermal sphere. I'll just start by saying this. What you need is this modified form of the Poisson equation for gravity, which is just that this is what defines the isothermal sphere. That it's in this mean, is this gravity in this mean field limit, where basically the density of the object is related to its potential in sort of this recursive way. And beta is just defined to be like is an effective temperature, which I will define at half time. But you don't have to know that much about it. Just for you, beta is just some number. It's determined by the system. And it just comes from the previous problem, if you want to work through that. Anyway, but this is it. I mean, this is on the assignment. You don't have to write it down. I just want to this is the one exterior assumption that I want to explain. But the other thing I wanted to just go through is that you may have seen this before. In fact, you probably have. But I just want to go through the calculation for 2.11 or 2.11 of why the like 2.11 is a problem with degeneracy pressure, the pressure that comes from fermions whenever at zero temperature. What supports white dwarfs? basically just the Fermi exclusion principle in action on a macroscopic scale. So, I mean, as you all know, white dwarfs are stars that are so compact that they basically they're being supported by the exclusion pressure of the electrons. That is the energy states of the electrons. They're merged. They're not just in not just looking at the individual atoms' electron energy states, but there's a macroscopic quantum state throughout the star, so that for each electron there's a there's a bunch of different energy levels, and there can only be two electrons per energy level because of the spin. And so what happens is that you're as your momentum p increases, the population of the state, this is a classic thing, is that as the temperature gets really cold for fermions, I mean, you already all know this, I'm sure, I just want to go through it. The point is that if you get a very cold fermionic gas, it's condensed, then you get a set of energy levels, and you get the external free electrons of the system start filling up these energy levels. And because it's so close, because the density is so high, that electrons that are macroscopically separated are nonetheless all in the same quantum system. And so they can't, both more than two can't occupy any single energy level. And so the upshot of that is that, because the star has lots of electrons, lots and lots of electrons. And so what you end up doing is you start filling up lots of energy levels to the point where the highest energy, the lowest free energy state, the lowest energy state that hasn't been filled yet is actually very energetic. And this is the fancy thing that happens with fermion gases. And that place where the first free spot falls is known as the Fermi momentum or Fermi energy. And by recognizing that this phenomenon occurs, you can find out that the behavior of gases dominated by this phenomenon is very weird. Basically, so the FP is the equation for how populated a particular state is, like how many individual members fill up a particular state. And so this is given by the distribution. For fermions and bosons, this is given by this formula. So basically, for bosons, where this is a minus number, this occupation number can get arbitrarily high. Bosons then condensate, for instance, wherever everything goes to the bottom one. But for fermions, it's a positive number, so it can't get arbitrarily high. No matter what you do here, this just this maxes out one. And so then you just get the number of occupants of a particular state being governed by the spin. And then you get the size of the state, which is governed by Planck's constant, which is of course the definition of Planck's constant. You could just call it H cubed. So that's fermions phase space, extremely brief. The point is, though, that if If you have this highly condensed situation, this is approximately equal to 1, or 2 rather, or just g over 2 pi h bar cubed for p less than p Fermi, and 0 for p greater than p Fermi. So just a plateau. So the density of state is governed by this, basically just by 1 over the over Planck's constant. And so then, like, for instance, the total number of states is just the integral of this over all of phase space, and you get g over a cubed 4 pi over 3 p Fermi cubed, things like that, right? Probably all seen this before. See this spherical gas. And so calculating the pressure due to this degeneracy of states, do basically the pressure is given by a similar integral. This f of p that times so just to make this a little bit gravitational for you, you remember that p mu nu for general relativity, those of you who know general relativity, the pressure part of this is really given by Tij, the part that, so it's T mu nu, if for a gas, T mu nu breaks into rho and then P subpart. And so the pressure for T mu nu that comes from this is given by basically the momentum squared divided by the energy, total energy. And then you sum up over all the different states. You get the total pressure. Okay, so the momentum in a state, the total energy of that state, times the population of the state, integrated over phase space. And so then you have to actually get an answer here. You have to decide what energy is. So there's basically two possibilities for non-relativistic things. Energy is just mass. For relativistic things, energy is equal to the momentum times t. So there's just the question of whether the mass is bigger than the kinetic energy, or whether the kinetic energy dominates. Both of them can happen. And so if we just do non-relativistic first, then the pressure, it's like there's lots of p's around here. Maybe I should switch. I'll just call it pressure. 1 over m integral of d over h cubed integral over p to the 4th d omega p, right? Integral over d omega equals 4 pi. Oh yeah, there's also, sorry, I forgot. There's a factor of a third here that comes from taking the trace. So p over 5. And then, so this is just p to the 5th over 5. P Fermi to the 5th. So this is just, yeah, in this approximation, right? Does this make sense? And so the interesting thing about this is that we got this, the number here, which is going to be related to the, this is the number, I guess this is the number density, isn't it? Right, this is the number density, this is the number per volume. Anyway, so the actual density is going to be given by basically the mass of the particles times the number density. And so And that's going to be given by just gm over h cubed 4 pi over 3 f cubed. So the point here is that this factor of p to the 5 can be written, and this pressure scales as the number density, or the overall density to the 5/3 power, but the temperature is dropped out. So we get this very funny pressure. It's just related to density, and basically the question is just like how flat this is here. And then you can do it again, and there's all these prefactors, but you can get that from the book. And then the pressure in the relativistic case, is exactly the same, only the integral will be a little different because it'll be over p cubed dp, right? Because and so therefore 1/4 p Fermi to the fourth, and therefore over 1/4 root of the fourth. And so you can find out, if you can find the pressure of the degenerate Fermi gas, you can always find it. You can find out if it's relativistic, or if you can find this relationship, this equation of state, then you can determine whether it's relativistic or not relativistic. Okay, so that's just a little background for the second problem, which you just assume for the purposes of the problem. Any questions about that? You've probably all seen this before, huh? No? Okay. This is a very important fact from statistical mechanics. And white dwarfs. This is how white dwarfs work. Anyway, I think it's really cool. Did you say you have any questions about it? Does that make sense? Anyway, so this is just Fermi exclusion principle in action. And then let me just zoom through. Well, I can't decide if it's really worth giving you the full mean field approximation to gravity. It's a little involved. Well, we don't really have time because we were supposed to get done early. Does anybody want to stay and learn this, or would y'all rather just go?
I have a couple of questions I'd like to ask on the problems just reading through.
Oh, sure. Well, let's go through that first. No, okay. we have time actually to go through this. But
okay, I'm reading through 210. I basically understand what's going on in the first couple points. It's just C is the problem, basically just saying that it's unstable. First thing mm-hmm. I don't get is, where's the E come from in the equation for lambda? So what is that, an energy? What energy?
Good question. Probably the binding energy. Okay. I can cheat and look in the solution. Just make sure I answered that question right. Yeah, it's the total of the total energy. It's the kinetic plus the potential for the whole thing. So it's the thermal energy basically. Plus the total potential energy.
Okay, and it looks like getting into discussion on entropy there. It seems like we might have to go back to parts and other questions.
Possible. But which part for C?
Yeah.
Okay, well actually, you know what? You can probably just, let's not worry about C really. The if you for this, the what I really want to focus on for this week is the numerical part, which is B.
Okay.
That's why I didn't even pay attention to C, to be honest, when I was designing this. Yeah. So the I mean that the entropy thing is important, but since is this if you find the numerics really simple for you, then by all means do C. But if going through this numerical bit is going to take some effort, and that's really what I want you to focus on this week. Is this is your week to sort of like flex your computing. Okay. We have time to go through the mean field thing. Do you have any more questions? Any other questions on the problem set? Start with. You can email my questions during the week. I'm going to go through this mean field thing because. I'm actually going to define that entropy, I think. Yeah, I am. So, No, actually, I think I'm not. I think I'm just it's just it'll take longer than half an hour to go through. It's interesting. I would encourage you to read it, but I don't know if it's really worth it.
That in part 9?
Yes, it's problem 2.9.
Okay.
The basic idea I can sketch it really briefly is the basic idea is that you can define the entropy implicitly through a sum over all of the different. Over it, if you're looking at some system with volume V with n particles in it, then you can take the entropy, and the entropy is basically it's going to be defined by the total number of states available to the particles in the problem, which would be an integral over all the locations where all of them can be, the momentums that all of them can hold, subject to the constraint that their energy is fixed, basically. And you can basically approximate this very very well by if you just assume that all of them have the same energy, then you can use one of the previous questions to approximate this as just an integral over the volume, where the energy is given by some kinetic energy minus the point by point potential energy. So basically, the idea is that if you have all of them having the same kinetic energy, and the only thing that differs among them is just the potential energy of their point versus every other point, then you can simplify this, and you can do this integral, and you get this with some prefactor that doesn't matter. And then what you can do is break all of space up into little boxes, one box per particle, and then you can turn this integral over all of these things into a bunch of sums over the boxes where the particles live. And you can, what that sum essentially gives you is is a way to actually do this integral, and the trick, the thing that makes it mean field is that this whole integral is going to be approximated by the place where this entropy defined in this way is not changing with the number of subdomains you select. And then you can use this. So you break this into, right. So this is, right. You don't break it, not one per particle. You break it into a bunch of subdomains, each of which you can treat as having independent entropy. And then you sum up the entropy for all the different parts. So there's NA of these. And there's NA particles in each of these. And so you can basically look at how the total entropy changes as you vary this, and you just say that the real entropy is going to be and then right, because if you want, one of the ways to calculate the entropy is just like break it up into little boxes and then change the size of those boxes and the number of states available to one little box here, and then you'll have a different number of states available if you change these box sizes. It turns out that it's adequate to forget this entropy, just to say that to just define the box size for which the entropy is stationary, that there is some particular box size that maximizes the entropy per box. And then once you set that, then that gives you a good approximation to the whole system. It's just it gives you some idea about how much entropy is in the whole system based on this. And that lets you basically write what it ends up telling you is that there's going to be some constant equal to the natural log of the density of particles, which is sort of a bit of a miracle, plus 1 over some temperature, an integral over the potential, so this is the density of particles plus potential of at x due to y summed over all y, as you take a continuum limit back. And so once you get to this point, then you're set, because basically this gives you a relationship between potential and rho. And then, but then you also know that gravity is true. So you know that if this potential is in fact the gravitational potential, then this is also a function of rho. So you have 2 equations for rho. One equation for rho just tells you is basically that if everything in the system is interacting only through this one potential force, then you can look at the entropy of the system and calculate the relationship between the density and the potential. And then you can couple this to the Poisson equation, and then and combine those to get the mean field gravity that I told you about. So you can just solve this for rho.
You can probably just move the book to the far left side. I think the torque was causing it to stick better.
Oh, I see. Yeah, that's clever. Okay. Yeah. Anyway, so this is a trick, and so it's kind of a cool thing. It's worth going through all of the details. I've really done a bad job of explaining it, but the point is that you can. It's this sort of miraculous thing that these subdomains can be used as a crutch to figure out what the approximate behavior of the whole system is.
You're cutting the box up, and then you're putting the constraint that the box sizes are such that they maximize the entropy.
Yeah. And that turns out to be adequate for that. That turns out to be a good estimate. Whenever that's true, that gives this when this holds, then you get this relation. That's exactly when this holds, you get this special relation, and that's what is necessary. That's what defines the isothermal theory. Like, is a particular case. Radially, is basically the radially symmetric case of this. So that's the one thing that I don't think he actually said in the problem is that you can assume radial symmetry, which you will need to do. Let's see if there's anything else that you should know. You just need to know. Yeah, assume radial symmetry, and then you'll do it numerically. The one thing that we might get into is you can use the isothermal sphere like this part. This part C that I'm telling you not to worry about, this instability they're talking about, it's sort of related to other phenomena that we may talk about later. All right, so that's enough. Anything else? Any other questions you have for now? No. All right, great. That's it for this week.
Will next week be a shorter class?
No, I